Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Hometown Heroes, coming to you live today from the Shetler Conference Center, part of the Radisson Hotel in downtown Fresno. We're at the KMJ Lifestyle Expo. It's already been a fantastic day, and the festivities continue until 3 o'clock this afternoon. So come on down and say hi. The Lifestyle Expo, put on by KMJ here in downtown Fresno, right across from the Saroyan Theater, Cellon Arena. You know where it is, and we'd love to see if you can get down here before 3 o'clock. The show today is going to be a little different. Instead of just spending my entire hour with one veteran of World War II, we're going to hear some different angles and maybe some things that you at home have been curious about over the years. We've had two great seminars already here this morning, one on preserving family history and one on becoming an author. One of my guests today participated in both because he is an author of a book about his father and 43 other sailors aboard the USS Dale, a destroyer in World War II. That book is called Tales from a Tin Can, and we'll hear from Michael Olson in the second half of the show today. The first half of the show, we're going to spend with two people, neither of whom served during World War II. One of them remembers it very clearly. Another one has learned quite a bit recently, but I'll let them tell you their story. And it's the story of someone who's not here to tell his own story. John R. Machado was a sailor aboard the USS Mississippi, a battleship in World War II. And to hear more about it, let's get the perspective of Maury Garcia here. Maury, John Machado was your sister-in-law's brother. Is that the best way of saying it? He would have been your brother-in-law had he survived World War II.
I guess he would have, yes.
Now, where did this come from, your desire to find out information about him? Because on this program, we talk to people who are still here to tell their stories, but there are a lot of people listening at home who maybe had a relative who has since died or who died in the war and is not here to tell the stories. So you got this idea. You would like to fill in some of the blanks of his story. You knew he was killed during World War II, serving in the Navy. How much more than that did you know? I guess you had a date, right, in the ship?
That's about it. The date that he was wounded, the date that he passed away, the name of the ship, and we had numerous times discussed a little bit about John, and then this last Thanksgiving we had another discussion, and on the way home I got to thinking about him, and it sort of started all from there.
And I imagine when you were discussing it, you were discussing it a bit with your sister-in-law. She's here as well. Olga Machado Garcia, I'm not going to tell you how old she is. If she wants to tell you, then she might. She doesn't look nearly as old as she is, I'll tell you that. But when you talk about your brother, you probably always had some questions about what happened to him, right? Tell us, if you can, a little bit about your brother, what you remember about him from before the war, and what you knew at the time about what happened to him.
Before the war, he was 3 years older than I was. We were very close. And I was 16, and he's probably, 19? And I couldn't date. But John, we had, at that time, our social life was we had a little small public dances.
This in Manteca.
Right,
Manteca, California.
Correct, and we'd go into Stockton, which was larger. And he knew I liked to dance, so he would take me. So we'd do a lot of dancing, and then we had a lot of yearly. Practically the whole San Joaquin Valley have Portuguese celebrations.
Oh, yeah, the festas.
The festas. That's the only time we got a new dress or an outfit, you know. And so we used to, but my folks were there, of course, also. But we were just very close, and he watched over me.
So when he went into the Navy and went off to war, that must have been really hard for you. You lost not only your big brother, but your dance partner and
right,
your
right.
bodyguard, the guy
right,
looking out for
right,
you in Manteca.
Right, yes. But then I was a little bit older then I was able to date Donald.
Who's sitting right here, because they're still together.
Correct.
So he was in the service. Would you hear from him often?
Not that often. And he didn't actually write anything of what was happening. Of course, they'd censor that. And that he was fine. He loved us. And that was about it. The first time he came home was in 43. We didn't even know he was coming home at about 11 o'clock at night. The old 99 right through Manteca town, mm-hmm. And there's somebody's yelling at the door, I'm home, and it was John.
That must have been a pretty exciting day.
Very, for my mother and dad, yes, all of us.
And then you had to watch them go back to war.
Yes.
And how often did you think of it? Was it when you say your prayers every night, you're thinking about him and praying about him? I mean,
Definitely.
And what do you remember about finding out that he had been killed at sea?
Well, we got a telegram saying that he was seriously wounded. Shrapnel hit his head and paralyzed him. They thought it was going to be paralyzed forever. And that was all. And they would keep us informed not to say the name of his ship or anything. And we didn't hear. I kept writing to the Mississippi and never got an answer. And then, about 2 weeks before Christmas, I was working at the Army Engineers Depot in Lathrop, which is between Manteca and Stockton.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Stockton with a friend to buy some Christmas presents. But on the way, I had then catch the Greyhound back to Manteca, and my dad was always there waiting for me. And he started talking to me, and he was very emotional, and he says, "I think John died." I said, "What do you mean John died?" And what had happened, we received a letter from probably Dutch New Guinea with his ring, and they send it to the supply officer in San Francisco to wait for the rest of his gear to come, and then that had come to the family. And so Mom and Dad, they couldn't read the English, that paper came, but it was a box.
So they had a box with a ring, but they can't read the writing.
Right, and they thought, but before they saw the ring, they thought it was a Christmas present. Hmm. And they were arguing who was going to open it. And when they opened it, it's this ring. And so they knew something was wrong, so they went to a friend, a little gasoline station down the road, a friend of the family, to read and tell him. And they said, "Mr. Machado, I think Johnny died." So when Dad picked me up and told me about this, so the next day Dad and I went to the Red Cross in Stockton. I took the paper, and it was this a copy that was not signed. And a copy, and so the Red Cross took over, and they verified then that Johnny had died on the 24th of November, and this is about 2 weeks before Christmas, and this is how we found out about his death.
Obviously, that is a day that has stuck with you for all this time.
Yes.
How hard was that to deal with at the time, and how did you deal with it?
Like everything else, you have to. You know, it was very emotional for Mom and Dad. They understood English, but not speak it very well. They did. They finally got their citizenship papers. And he was a very loving son. He worked the dairy. When he sold out, he worked in the cannery, which my father worked, and he gave some of his wages to help. And he was just a loving son, a loving brother. We were very close.
And I'm sure when you got that news, it brought up all kinds of questions in your mind. What happened to him? Where was he? How did this happen?
Yes.
And they couldn't answer any of those questions for you.
No. And once Johnny was on, after he was wounded, he was on the hospital, the USS Mississippi, from the 1st to the 7th. Then the USS Hope, a hospital ship, came, took Johnny then to Dutch New Guinea, which we did not know, you know. Mm-hmm. And then that's where he died. So any deaths that's related to the USS Mississippi, Johnny is not included because he did not die on ship. And so it was years later then we got a letter, some official there, where he was buried in Dutch New Guinea. We did not get his body back for 5 years.
Wow.
49.
And then from then, 1949, more than a half century, even into a new century, until this last Thanksgiving, still you knew nothing more than what you just told us.
Correct.
Until your brother-in-law
decided
to do some digging.
Right.
And we're going to hear more from Maury about that. We need to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we'll hear what this family was able to discover and how much it has meant to them over the last year. This is Hometown Heroes. You're listening to News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes with you live from KMJ's Lifestyle Expo at the Radisson and the Shetler Conference Center downtown Fresno. Let's continue now with the story. And if you're just joining us, it's the story of a sailor who was killed in World War II. How are we hearing that story? Well, that is part of the story itself. John R. Machado was the sailor in question. He was aboard the battleship USS Mississippi in World War II. You've heard from his sister, Olga, of her memories of him before the war, learning of his death, and then the unanswered questions that were with her until just a few months ago, because her brother-in-law, Morris Garcia, was able to uncover some things the family never knew about. So, Morris, we don't have much time to cover it, but we're going to try. You told us at the start of the show you were driving home from Thanksgiving dinner, and it was just on your mind that you could try to find out some more information. So what was step one to trying to learn what happened to John Machado on the Mississippi?
Well, like everybody else does today, I got on the internet and basically went into and brought up information on the Mississippi, battleship Mississippi. And when I brought that up, one of the things that I found out that there was a Mississippi alumni group. And so I went to that website and found the phone number of the president of that group, and then called that person. And of course, introduced myself, told them what the purpose of my call was, and that I was trying to find out anything about John R. Machado and what happened to him on November 1st, 1944. And that gentleman didn't know John, didn't know what happened, but he sent me the roster of that group of gentlemen and patriots. And I believe it's like almost 200 names were on the list. And so I started right from the beginning calling these guys. And fortunately, the first call I made was a gentleman by the name of Mr. Brewster. And when I introduced myself and told him what I was trying to find out, he recalled something. He says, you know, let me look and I'm going to get back to you. So I sat for about an hour waiting for him to get back to me. And what he did is he got my email. So he emailed me two pieces of paper from a diary that another sailor from the Mississippi, John U. Yakshik, had written, and in his diary he covered November 1st, 1944 and what happened on that date. And when he described what they called the incident where they were in battle, and shrapnel of shell exploded, and shrapnel from that shell injured two sailors critically, one with a shrapnel wound to the head through his helmet, I just knew that was John Machado.
So that was a clue, but you still had more distance to cover to uncover the rest of the story. So you continue to call these different sailors. Now you've got a piece of that diary. What was the next big step in your journey of discovery?
Well, then I kept just going alphabetically, and I got Charles Dahlstrom. And Charles was a 5.25 gunner on the port side of the Mississippi. John was a gunner on the right, on the starboard side.
Mm-hmm.
And Dahlstrom recalled that incident. And then he sent me just tons of information and pictures and whatnot. He didn't know John's name, but he recalled that incident and the date that it happened, etc. So, you know, that was another piece of the puzzle. And then...
So your treasure hunt, or maybe Hansel and Gretel's a better illustration. You're finding a crumb here and a crumb there, and you're hoping there's something big coming.
That's correct. And then finally, I got to a fellow by the name of Jack Hurd. And I called, his daughter answered the phone, and she said, you know, Dad's gone out to an appointment, but what do you want? And I told her what I was after, and then I hung up. Well, she turned to her dad and said, this guy wants to know about John R. Machado, November 1st, 1944, that got hit by shrapnel. Well, as the father went out the door, he says, hey, you get back to that guy. I remember I was looking at him when that happened. And so she called me back and said, told me this. And so she says, Dad will be back in about 2 hours. So I sat by that phone for 2 hours.
I can imagine. I bet you would. And when he finally called back?
He called back, and he was a 40-millimeter gunner that had was on a platform 10 feet above where John's gun position was. And what had happened, there was a kamikaze plane came in. They were shooting at it. They thought it was going to hit the Mississippi. It veered off. It hit the destroyer Abner Reed, exploded. The Abner Reed was on fire. They had to get rid of all their ordnance. One of the things they did is they fired off their torpedoes. And the reason the captain of the Abner E did that because he was afraid the ship would blow up and kill all the sailors. So he wanted to give them time to get off. Anyway, those torpedoes were coming towards the Mississippi, and so the captain of the Mississippi ordered all the guns to train on that torpedo wake. And so what happened is John, you know, brought his 5.25 gun down, and then the 40 millimeters and the 20 millimeters were all shooting at this wake. And
trying to blow up the torpedo before it blew up their ship.
Absolutely.
Right.
And what happened, the concussion from either John's gun or one of the nearby guns blew up a canvas cover that covers the 40 millimeters that somebody had placed in the wrong place. When it flew up, the gunner on a 20 millimeter started to shoot. That shell hit that canvas cover, exploded, and that was a shrapnel that came back and hit John and penetrated the helmet.
So already, after all these years, more than 60 years of not knowing any of this, you're getting the actual information of what exactly happened to your relative. But it even got better for you, because on top of just the information and the facts, you ended up getting some pretty powerful emotion, too, because you didn't stop calling there. And probably a lot of people would have stopped calling there. But how did you uncover the rest of what you got for your family?
Well, I was still after someone that personally knew John or had a picture of him, had taken a photo of him on board with them or something like that. So I kept on going down the alphabet, and I got to Mr. Redmond. And I called, and I gave him my introduction about John Machado and shrapnel wound. And as soon as I said that, he said, "Oh, Machado, oh, Machado." And I said, just take it easy, Mr. Redmond. I mean, just take your time. Anyway, he came back, and he was John's gun captain on the 5.25 millimeter gun.
So clearly, the moment that you mentioned the name, you could tell there was a visceral reaction for him and an emotional attachment to John.
Absolutely.
You could hear that in his voice over the phone.
You could. He was from Providence, Rhode Island, and there were a lot of Portuguese people that lived in Providence. He had a lot of Portuguese friends, and when John came on board, he knew John was Portuguese. He took a real liking to John, and he was the one that gave John his first morphine shot when John was wounded.
When you heard that, was all the blood rushing to your head? Did you feel adrenaline everywhere? How great did that feel to get these details?
I'll have to say that, you know, tears came to my eyes. I mean, he was actually, Mr. Redmond was, I could tell he was on tears on the other end of the phone.
Now, when you were driving home from Thanksgiving dinner and just thinking about that, did you imagine that you could find all these kinds of different things that you were eventually able to find?
Absolutely not. It just amazes me that after 66 years that you can find that detailed information. And of course, a lot of it was luck, and some of, you know, a lot of it was hard work and a lot of phone calls, 75 phone calls and emails back and forth and whatever. But all these veterans that I talked to, they just wanted to help out so much. You know, in fact, some of them that didn't remember were just, maybe I send me a picture, maybe I'll remember him. You know, I did send pictures and a batch of information to about 20 of them to maybe recharge their memories, you know, but basically found two guys, and that was Jack Hurd and Mr. Redmond, that, you know, basically knew John and knew what happened and were with him.
And the odds of finding that in this day and age, A, that they're still alive, B, that you can get a hold of them, C, that they remember. Those are some pretty stiff odds that you were able to overcome with all of that. And part of the puzzle, too, was the fact that some war diaries had been preserved because someone else wrote down this history. And you've done a great thing. You've taken all these accounts from these different men. You've included photos, and you printed that up for your family. So now they have everything that you were able to discover. And I want to bring your sister-in-law back in now, the sister of John Machado. So when your brother-in-law comes to you, Olga, and I understand he was a little nervous about bringing this up because knowing that it was friendly fire that killed your brother,
right,
he didn't know how you'd take it.
Right.
Take the story from there. How did he break it to you, and what did it mean to you to finally know what happened to your brother?
Well, it was shocking. 66 years, we had put closure. Brought a lot of memories. I can understand what happened. It happens all the time. And I don't know if I was happy or not, but I am now that we got the true information about Johnny. and I'll add it to my scrapbook. And I'm very proud of Morris.
I don't blame you. I can tell it means a lot to you. If you at home could see her eyes right now, you'd know that this is a very powerful thing for her.
He was only 6 years old when we got married. I didn't think he would be able to do anything like this because he was a brat.
Oh, he was the little brat brother-in-law, huh?
Correct.
Now he's made up for it.
Correct.
And Morris, I imagine that not only has this impacted your family, I bet it meant a lot to those veterans to be able to fill in these blanks for you.
It did, and I've sent them all a package of all of this, and one of them, Charles Dahlstrom, is actually putting the 32-page story and then the big book of all the backup information into the Nimitz Library in Fredericksburg, Texas, and that's where Admiral Nimitz was raised. So all of John's story is going to be in the Admiral Nimitz Library and Museum.
That is terrific. Well done. I'm sorry that we're running short on time, but thank you both so much for being here. And Morris, is there anything, if there's somebody at home that is listening to this and saying, wow, I've got to find out what happened to my dad or my grandpa or my uncle, is there any advice that you would share with them if they are thinking about trying to take on a project like this?
Well, just get started and don't quit.
You didn't quit. And Olga, you're pretty thankful for that, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
All right. Morris Garcia, Olga Garcia, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to hear the story of some other veterans, more Navy men, and another family tale of how things were learned many years after World War II, and what can come when you take on the task of trying to fill in a few blanks in history. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Frontline of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you live from KMJ's Lifestyle Expo. It's been another fun year here at the Expo. Great to meet some of you. Had some entertaining seminars, well attended this morning, on preserving family history and becoming an author. And the gentleman you're about to meet was part of both of those. By the way, for more on that preserving family history seminar, what we talked about, and also about the guests today, go to our website, kmjnow.com. You'll see Hometown Heroes of the Lifestyle Expo, and you can read all about it. Right now, they've got a fashion show going on inside, but I've been managed to pull Michael Olson away from the fashion show and spend some time with me here. Michael Olson is an author. He's a broadcaster. He has a syndicated radio show, but he's on this program today because of a journey that I think has meant more to him than just about anything in recent years. A journey he didn't see coming, but one that I think you're going to enjoy the ride as you ride along with us. His book is Tales from a Tin Can. That's also linked on our website, kmjnow.com. You've heard a lot of destroyer sailors on this program talk about the tin cans that got him through the war. The USS Dale is the tin can that this book is about, a Farragut-class destroyer in World War II that was at Pearl Harbor on December 7th and was in Tokyo Bay when the surrender papers were signed. So, Michael, enough of me telling your story. I want to hear your story.
Well, thanks
a lot.
How
did this all start with you getting interested in some veteran stories? You have a very personal connection, don't you?
Well, I do. Thank you very much for having me here today, Paul. I mean, you folks out in Radio Land are really missing out on something here at the KMJ Lifestyle Expo. We're talking barbecue and
that is queuing for
babes.
You some good stuff.
Barbecue and babes. And Paul's sitting here in the lobby doing his radio show, and all of these beautiful women are walking right in front of you. Nice job, Paul. Good deal.
Well, as long as I can keep you in that seat to talk to me here about your story, we'll be all right. But you didn't see this coming, and you've had a varied career. You've worked in network television. You've worked in newspaper journalism. You've been here and there and everywhere. You're a Vietnam veteran yourself. But you're just hanging out with your dad one day in Santa Cruz, and he says, hey, let's go talk to my World War II buddy.
Yeah, he says, and my father, like many World War II vets, Paul, did not talk very much about his experience in the war.
It was for me, it's a good thing, because I wouldn't have this show if they had told their stories then. They're waiting until now, so that's why we get to hear them every week. Anyway.
And they are waiting till later in life. But my father never said much at all, and he came out to visit me in Santa Cruz, and he said, son, I'd like to have lunch with Hal Reichert, with whom I served aboard the USS Dale in World War II. And I said, sure, Pop, would love to have lunch with one of your shipmates. So we got together and sat down for lunch. And you know, when you put two sailors together who served aboard a ship 65 years ago, they just start talking. And so Hal started telling a story about how the USS Dale was the first ship to escape Pearl Harbor. while the Pearl Harbor was under attack by the Japanese.
Which and I guess probably got your attention a little bit.
It really got my attention. I just said, wait a minute. And I ran out to the car, being a radio guy, and I had my tape recorder out in the car, and I got my tape recorder and came back. And so I recorded this incredible story of Hal Riker told about the escape from Pearl Harbor. And by the time he was finished telling that story, tears were streaming down his face, and it was just, like, touching. So I said, well, Dad, you never said anything about this. Tell me what's going on here. And my dad, he still wasn't ready to talk, so kind of shrugged me off. So I looked into the history of the ship, learned that it won 12 battle stars from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay, which meant, of course, that the Dale was in just about every major naval engagement in World War II in the Pacific. And in spite of being shot at many thousands of times, the ship was never hit, although it came close many, many times, and sometimes from fire from our own ships. So here was a ship that experienced the whole World War II in the Pacific. So I thought, you know, I bet I could get more interesting stories like that and get some time with my papa if I just started going to these ship reunions with him. So every year the Dale had a ship reunion someplace in the United States. One of the shipmates would put it on.
And this was about 10 years ago is starting to take place?
So it was a 10-year process. So I got to see America in a very interesting way from the eyes of these tin can sailors. So every year we'd go to some place out there in the world and experience a reunion. And every year I'd take my tape recorder and I'd record a story, a bunch of stories. You know, and you get these guys together, they just love to tell their stories, so away you go. And then one day, about 10 years later, I was taking a shower and I realized that I had the whole World War II in the Pacific as seen from this one ship. And it steamed through just about everything. So I went to Washington, D.C., and I got the ship's war diary, and which gave me a timeline to plug all these stories in.
Because you're hearing story here, story there. You don't necessarily know the time, the place, the situation.
And neither did the sailors.
Of course not.
You know, because oftentimes the sailors only saw something happening. They really didn't have a context, or they didn't know where they were or why they were there or anything. So having the ship's war diary gave me the schematic, you know, to plug all of these 424 stories in sequence. So what I ended up with was World War II in the Pacific, as seen from the 44 guys aboard the USS Dale that steamed from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. And it's some incredible stories of the war, but more of the war, the incredible stories of life aboard a tin can. And, you know, when you think about this tin can, they call them tin cans because they were so thin-skinned that you could take a hunting rifle and shoot through the hull. That no armor at all. Their only thing that allowed them to survive was speed. And so speed was what kept them going. So, and the ship was built in 1935, which it was 300 feet long, 30 feet wide, 250 people lived aboard it. And aboard the ship, no internal passageways, Paul, which meant that if you wanted to go from where you slept to where you ate, you had to go topside, which meant that, which is fine when you're out there in the South Pacific, you know. But this ship spent 9 months in the Bering Sea in 1940.
Burr. And what I love about the book is all of that is in there, and what you talked about, having that lunch with your father and his buddy, what got your interest was this Pearl Harbor story, and how was the Dale the first one to get out of the harbor, which was crucial, because if ships had not been able to get out of the harbor, the whole fleet there could have been decimated. The carriers weren't there, but the ones that were there could have been. And in your book, that's what you start out with all these different sailors saying where they were on December 7th, how it happened for them. And not only does I think that suck you into the story of the book, I think for sailors who weren't on the Dale, who were on another destroyer there, were on any ship in Pearl Harbor, were on land at Pearl Harbor, or throughout the war, were in similar situations, I think this is like speaking their language. This saying, this is what it was like for me. And I'm sure you've gotten that kind of feedback marketing this book.
Yeah, and, you know, ironically enough, when I put the book together, I originally thought the stories The USS Dale served as the model for Herman Wouk's Kane Mutiny, because so many stories in the Dale, including an ice cream mutiny, including the typhoons, all of these things happened to the USS Dale. So I figured, well, Herman Wouk obviously used the Dale as his basis for his book. But then I get to talking with other tin can sailors on other ships.
They say the same thing.
We had an ice cream mutiny, too.
And for the listeners at home who are saying an ice cream mutiny, what is that? Explain that a little bit. Ice cream was actually a pretty hot commodity in the South Pacific.
Can I read a little story?
You're welcome to read from the book. The book, again, is Tales from a Tin Can. It's in hardcover and paperback. And if you catch Michael by the end of this show here at the conference center downtown, the Radisson Conference Center, he might sell you a book and sign it for you. So you've got about 20 minutes to work on that. Go ahead, Michael.
So here's a story about ice cream and Pearl Harbor.
All right.
Okay. The Dale is making her escape from Pearl Harbor. She just got up steam. She's way up at the top of Pearl Harbor, and she's just getting up steam and heading out into the channel and making her run for the harbor mouth. This is from Ernest Schnabel. As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. One young bosun mate named Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that collected in port. And there was a lot of it, too, because in port we had all these awnings rigged to keep the tropical sun off the decks. You also had to get rid of all the wooden swabs, buckets, and boxes, because if a machine gun bullet from Japanese planes were to strike any of it, slivers would fly all over the place just like shrapnel. So Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the wooden ice cream geedunk. He grabbed it and was just about to toss it over the side when one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute." Back in 1941, ice cream was a mighty precious commodity in the destroyer Navy. Today you can find ice cream and sugar candy on almost any street corner, but back then we tin can sailors had to get our ice cream off the bigger ships that had the equipment to make it. They almost always figured out ways to make us pay for it, too. So that young bosun struck a nerve when he made moves to toss all the ship's ice cream over the side. In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. Then Fuller kicked the empty wooden geedunk over the side, so what you saw was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out into the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream and watching World War II break out all around them.
So here is the Arizona in flames, the Utah capsizing, the Oklahoma fighting for its life, and the Dale is cruising out of the harbor with the sailors on the deck eating ice cream.
And it sounds funny, but you know, when you think about it, what else were they going to do? You know, you can't kick the ice cream geedunk over the side. I mean, the world might be ending, but that's ice cream. You know,
if we're going down, we're going down with ice cream.
We're going down in style. That's right.
Now, one thing, and Michael participated, as I said, in both of the seminars that I hosted here today at the KMJ Lifestyle Expo. And
really,
the one thing that...
Really well-attended seminars, too. Folks, you missed out.
Well, next year. We'll do it again next year, and there is some information online at kmjnow.com for those of you who did miss it. But one thing that you said, I thought, was really powerful to those in the room. And you set it up by talking about the fact that you're a storyteller. As I said, you've worked in a lot of different media roles. Mm-hmm. And you always saw yourself as a storyteller, and then it hit you upside the head that you had one of the greatest stories you could ever run into right in front of your eyes, and you'd never seen it.
And I just couldn't believe it. Here it was, and the way I relate that story was that after Tales from a Tin Can was published, I was invited to speak at, by an organization called Much Ado About Books in Jacksonville, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
They're the Friends of the Jacksonville Public Library put on a big event where they, you know, try to gin up interest in reading and in the library. So they bring in authors from all over the country, and the authors have the responsibility of talking to school kids and signing books and doing this, putting on the dog and pony show. So when they flew us there, our first thing was Thursday night, they had a big party for authors, which is always fun. As an author, you know that when you're an author, you're always standing in front of a bunch of people and they're looking at you.
Sure.
But here was an opportunity to mingle with other authors and kind of talk shop and whoop it up. And since somebody else was driving, we all had a glass or two too much wine. And, you know, there we go. So early the next morning, 6 o'clock my time, 9 o'clock East Coast time, they ushered me into a school auditorium filled with about 400 African-American fourth graders. Now, these kids were so excited to meet a real live author because they had been talked to, you know, by their teachers, had been talking to them for months. You know, you're going to get a chance to meet a real author, and you're going to get a chance to ask questions. And I just stood there in front of them and thought, uh-oh, what am I going to say? So without thinking, I held up my book and I said, you know, kids, this story, Tales from a Tin Can, was in front of me all of my life. And I didn't know it. And I'm a professional storyteller, and I didn't see this story. And the only reason I found the story was just by accident one day when my father asked me to lunch with one of his shipmates, and the story came out. And because of that accident, I was able to enjoy a full 10 years of wonderful exploration with my father. And in resulting in this beautiful book that was published. But, you know, you kids out there, you're just like me. You're not ready to listen to your parents, and your parents aren't ready to talk to you. But you have to be ready, because one day your parents are going to want to tell you their story. And when they do, you have to be ready, because if you miss that story, you'll regret it for the rest of your life. And the next morning, these kids showed up at the Jacksonville Public Auditorium, and they had their parents in tow. They brought their parents in to meet me. And I think, you know, of all of the things that I've done in my career as a writer and a storyteller, that was one of the high points, because I think it really touched a lot of lives that way.
And who knows how it'll impact them down the road.
Yeah.
And clearly there's been an impact. Obviously, this was a labor of love for you, and you learned so much about your father that you never knew about before. I imagine this meant the world, not just to the sailors you interviewed, a lot of whom have since passed on since you interviewed them, but to the families of sailors who weren't around anymore, because now they have an idea of those stories that were never told to them. Is there a comment that one of those sailors or a sailor's family has made to you that just kind of stands out, that put the biggest smile or brought you the most satisfaction?
I can't think of any one thing. You know, the thing that really gets me is are those people who did not get a chance to hear the story of their parents. That is what really touches me the most. They'll often come up to me in events such as this, and you'd say, you know, Michael, I didn't get a chance. I didn't get to do it. I didn't get to hear my parents' story. And you can always see this great sense of loss in their lives because they didn't make that connection. And I just say, well, here, mm-hmm. you can ride with me, you know. Mm-hmm. I'll be happy to share the relationship I was able to enjoy with my parents because of this book with you. And I think it does help a lot of people come to grips, you know, with the life their parents led before they were born, essentially.
So you've been to these reunions, you've interviewed so many sailors. The Dale has since had its last reunion, which you were heavily involved in, and there are very few of the men that you interviewed for the book still around. That in itself probably tells you did something important, because you were able to do it before it was too late. That's what this show is about. People say, well, they're dying at more than 1,000 every day. They're going to be gone soon. Why are you even bothering trying to get one a week? Well, that's one more than would happen otherwise. And what you were able to do, I know, meant a lot to them. Do you ever pause and think, wow, I could have missed this. I just got this in time.
Well, I'm so grateful for the opportunity. Folks, my father passed away about 3 months ago at the age of 91. And you know, I was able to give his eulogy at his funeral, from which I read 3 Tales from the Tin Can.
Of course.
And because they're like lessons for me as I go into the world without him. They were kind of gifts from my father, from the greatest generation. But on his passing, I sent a notice to all his shipmates. And the only response I got, Paul, was from the children of his shipmates. So that really tells you that they're going very, very fast.
And you caught them just in time.
And I caught them just in time. So, folks, if you know a World War II vet out there, give them a hug. But don't give them too hard of a hug, because they're getting pretty frail, you know.
And get them to tell you their story before it's too late. Is there something, and the folks who listen to this show have heard so many of the stories from World War II veterans, they know what they're all about. But when you, and I'm sure you had some opinions going into it about your general perception of World War II people. What did you learn about them as a generation? What was important to them? Why they did what they did that really impresses you looking back at everything you're able to gather?
Absolute fearlessness in the face of an overwhelming job that had to be done, and the odds of living were maybe 50-50, okay? And yet they went into this job that had to be done and did it. And now, when I finished Tales from a Tin Can, we were going to have the last reunion of the Dale, because the Dale sailors themselves were too old to do it themselves, so they said, you do it, Olson. So I put together the last reunion, and ironically enough, as I was putting it together, another USS Dale ship had to have a reunion in the same hotel in the same San Diego location. And I thought, that's interesting, you know. Me being captain of the good ship Serendipity, here it is. So we ended up having a dual reunion between the World War II veterans, with World War II veterans of the USS Dale, and Vietnam-era veterans of the USS Dale. Now, there's a real interesting juxtaposition in outlooks on life between those two generations. And my father was from World War II, and I was from the Vietnam era. And there's two different ways of looking at life. They won, we lost. And Paul has a tremendous sense of guilt that Vietnam era veterans carry about with them. Whether we deserve it or not, it makes no difference.
Right.
We carry that with us. And having been part of that reunion where we brought together the Vietnam-era veterans and the World War II veterans, I think that the Vietnam-era veterans were able to forgive themselves because of the love shown them by those World War II vets.
That is the neatest thing, when you see the generations get together and you see the mutual respect. I've talked to so many World War II guys who feel so bad for the Vietnam veterans who were treated poorly when they came back. I want you to do something. We only have a few minutes left. In the seminar this morning, you read the final story from your father that is in your book. The book, again, is Tales from a Tin Can. Michael Olson is the author. It's on Amazon. You can find it anywhere online, and you can find him still at the KMJ Lifestyle Expo for a few more minutes. And read that, Michael, and I want to take you one step further when you're done reading that passage.
Okay, folks, this is the last story in Tales from a Tin Can, and it happened in New York City after the Dale had been ordered to go from Tokyo Bay through the Panama Canal and up to New York City. And while the Dale sailors were celebrating the end of the war and being feted by the city of New York City, the Navy was tearing apart their ship, and the ship that had carried them through 5 years of hell without unscratched. But this is the last story from Robert Pat Olson. I don't remember much about the Dale's decommissioning ceremony. There wasn't much left of her by then anyway. We stood at attention in our dress blues while some officers gave speeches. They lowered her flag, folded it up, and then it was over. Oh, there was one other thing that happened. A Navy chaplain took us aside and gave us a going home lecture. Boys, he said, you've been out there in the Pacific fighting your way through cruel, hard times. You had to become cruel and hard to survive it. Now you're going home to a much different world, and you have to prepare yourselves for it. Soon, you'll be sitting down to dinner with an attractive young gal. Without thinking, you'll want to say, hey, show the friggin' butter over here. You had to be like that to survive the war, but the war is over. If you want to succeed with a pretty gal and build a new life for yourself, you have to change your ways when you walk out that gate. The next day, they shipped me off to Bremerton, Washington to be discharged, and then on to Billings, Montana, where I was to start my new life. Before the Navy, I worked for my dad, and so never held a real job before. But that didn't seem to matter. I had confidence. If I could survive the war, I could find a job and build a new life. Though I had always been very shy around girls, I was soon dating Irene, a pretty little country gal I met while home on leave. One day she said, I'm going to take you home and cook you dinner. She took me home to her family's farm near the little town of Belfry, where I met her father, mother, younger brother, and sister. Each was bright-eyed and rosy-cheeked. It was spring, and they had been working hard to bring their farm back to life from the long winter. When evening came, we all sat down to Irene's magnificent dinner. Everybody was happy, expectant, and very hungry. After grace was offered, I turned to Irene and said, "Will you please pass the butter?"
And I think so many veterans listening at home right now just heard that and could absolutely identify with that dynamic. And real quick, we're almost out of time, but if your dad hadn't been able to make that adjustment and hadn't been able to get out and meet a pretty lady, marry her, you wouldn't be here sitting next to me. If your dad hadn't made it home from the war, you would have never been born. When you look at that book and everything that's in it and everything that it's meant to so many different families and everything you hope it'll mean in the future, you ever stop and think, I wouldn't be here, none of this would have happened if my dad didn't make it?
That's right. Well, it's exactly what it means. Or if he would have said, hey, shove the friggin' butter over, I might not be here either.
So thanks to that chaplain who warned him, he was forewarned and ready. Well, Mike, we've got just about a minute left in the show here. I know people obviously know how to find your book, Tales from a Tin Can. Anything else you want to share with our audience about what this whole journey of discovery has done for you?
Well, like I said, the big lesson for me was forgiveness, Paul. You know, that to me was being a Vietnam vet and being with those World War II vets was a lesson in forgiveness. And I'd like to offer that to your audience, too, that they can find the same forgiveness that I found in their parents, if they're ready to hear the stories.
Well, there are some stories out there that still need to be told, and Michael Olson has told some great ones in Tales from a Tin Can. 44 different sailors aboard the USS Dale and their journey from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay in World War II. So I hope you'll take the time to read the book, find him, and he'll sign it for you. Michael, thanks so much for being here today.
Pleasure.
All right, that's Michael Olson, Tales from a Tin Can. We'll be back next week. We'll spend the whole hour with one World War II veteran next week, back to the regular plan. But thanks for listening today. Hope to see more of you at the KMJ Lifestyle Expo. This has been Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.